Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. The wonderful, the corrupt, and so wonderful at keeping secret the fact that it's corrupt. I'm not kidding. Ladies and gentlemen, this country, New Zealand, is like the Zimbabwe of the South Pacific. Honestly, we have taken lessons and given a ministerial post to Robert Mugabe in Figment. It's crazy. It's just that bad. Have you heard of Transparency International? They're supposed to tell everybody who is the least corrupt country in the world and who's maybe the most corrupt. You know how they figure that out? Well, what they do is they send out a form to the governments of all of these countries and ask them to fill in any corruption that has been happening in their country recently. New Zealand signs it, doesn't fill anything out, and sends it back blank. And hey presto, we're least corrupt in the top three countries in the world. The other two being Singapore, which is run by one man and his family, and Norway, which allows 500 immigrants a year out of a country of 14 million, where New Zealand allows 50,000 a year, and we have 4 million. My very special guest today is Colin Ross. That was off topic. Is Colin Ross. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you're the man behind the Ross Institute, Ross, I-N-S-T, Ross Inst, like an instant, but without the ant, right?
Right.
.com. RossInst.com is the website. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. Well, I'm a psychiatrist. I was born in Canada, grew up in Canada. I lived for briefly in Sicily, and then about 4 years in England, then back to Canada, went to medical school in Canada, 1977 to 81. Then I was in my psychiatry training, also in Canada, 81 to 85. Worked as a kind of medical school psychiatrist, 85 to 91. And then in 91, moved to Dallas, where I've been ever since. And I've got trauma programs at hospitals in Los Angeles, Dallas and Michigan that I consult to, and I'm involved in the programming and treatment and so on. And those are basically programs for adults with really horrible childhoods, all kinds of abuse and neglect and all kinds of mental health problems as a fallout.
Well, interesting you should say that, because that's kind of what I do for a living. You know, I get all these activists and everything like that, whistleblowers and what have you, that have had their lives destroyed over and over again by these ruthless criminal scumbags that they're trying to expose, but despite their best efforts, all they wind up doing is having their life effed up by these people. I kind of offer a platform to them to really bare their souls and be really comfortable and open and not fear being attacked or judged.
So it's a kind of societal level trauma you deal with?
Yeah. But the problem being, whenever you listen to somebody's trauma, part of it latches onto you.
Right.
Hmm.
There's a guy wrote a very interesting book chapter that I read some years ago. I've met him several times, a guy with a lot of varied interests. And he was in Brazil. He's done a lot of sort of cross-cultural studies. And this group he's describing in Brazil, it's a group of therapist healers. They've got the same treatment protocol for schizophrenia, multiple personality disorder, epilepsy, and demon possession. They treat all those the same way. And basically, everybody lies down in a circle. It's like therapist, client, therapist, client, therapist, client, with their heads at the center and their feet, you know, sticking out like spokes. And then the therapists kind of set things up, and they transfer the negative energy from the patient into the therapist, and the therapist then discharges it into the world. But sometimes the energy gets stuck in the therapist, and they have a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably about the same with me. I'm still learning how to kind of like take that energy and then bang it out somewhere, you know, right. almost like spew it out like ectoplasm in a figurative way.
Right.
But yeah, sometimes it does kind of compound on you, just kind of emotional trauma, stress, etc. It seems to be something I'm very specialist at sensing and having good instincts about with people. I can sometimes tell what people's problems is or past life traumas or what's happened to them, or at least be specifically suspicious after a few minutes of conversation. In so doing, and that only happens occasionally, you know, when I'm like pinging really well, it allows me to kind of ask them the right questions sometimes.
Well, that's a good skill for an interviewer.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'm an interviewer. I think I'm more like a therapist to the stars, you know.
You sure you're getting a lot of stars?
Well, in the conspiracy world, you know, in a cult sensation, fame sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, what I want to do is help to take the culture that we currently have, you know, this celebrity, wow, look at him, culture, and transmute that into actually caring about people who are famous for a very good reason.
Right.
You know, like Nikola Tesla, for example.
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't say I'm a Tesla expert, but I've read a book or two about him and kind of got the general idea. Very amazing, like incredible genius guy, obviously.
Yeah. So if somebody's an incredible genius and they've got really amazing stuff to say and they have done really amazing things, don't you think they should have fame and fortune far more deserving than, say, the likes of Paris Hilton or Honey Boo Boo?
Oh, it all depends on what dress they have, I think.
It does. But then again, the worst dressed can get just as much coverage as the best dressed.
Well, that's true. That's the way it is on Yahoo News now, though. It'll be like people killed in the Ukraine, Paris Hilton's new dress, so-and-so broke up with her boyfriend.
I recall there was some kind of large terrorism accident attack or something of that nature, you know, when they foiled that alleged bombing attack that was going to happen. They were going to blow up multiple airliners across the Atlantic a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on Fox News, and you know how they have those little runners down the bottom of the screen?
Right.
So during them talking about this very serious incident and this attack that's been foiled and how great it is that our security systems that we irradiate everybody is are working, and then it comes down the runner on the bottom of the screen. What's her name from the Destiny's Child? Beyonce. Yeah. Beyonce Knowles says she no longer likes the term bootylicious. Now, who puts these things together? Now,
somebody who's got the demographic down and wants to appeal to both, I guess.
Yeah. It's like, well, you know, people don't really like terrorism, but they do like Beyonce.
So let's just put something along a little bit Beyonce in there with the terrorism. That'll be really good for the demographic.
That's about it, I guess.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, the trivialization of the news is just ridiculous.
Can't get enough of it. They really can't. Now, Colin, speaking of, are you a psychiatrist or a psychologist? And more to the point, what's the difference?
Psychiatrists are smarter and more athletic and better looking. Those are the main differences.
Oh, that's what we all know. But yeah. There's an old saying in Hollywood, there's two things the film's about, what the film's about, what the film's really about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so the actual difference is, so a psychiatrist goes to medical school, gets an MD, and then could become a family doctor, an internist, becomes a psychiatrist, and then has the right to prescribe medications, admit people to hospital. Whereas a psychologist does a BA in psychology, then does a master's in psychology, and then could go into a clinical practice there or could go on to do a PhD. And they can do, they're more research oriented. They also have a therapy stream and they have a psychological testing stream.
And do these two fields marry much at all?
Well, they marry a little bit, but each has always got a machete behind the back. They're always fighting turf wars too.
Is there also like accusations from either side that the other side is quackery or something like that? You know, this kind of like brooding professional feud.
The quackery is not the mainstream to mainstream. They don't do the quackery accusations so much. The big threat to psychiatry is the psychologist getting prescribing rights.
It'll make you obsolete.
Yeah. Well, it'll make the psychiatrists who are totally invested in the only thing I do is prescribe drugs obsolete. Yeah. Wouldn't make me obsolete.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I have two questions for you. Number one, experimental drugs and things of that nature. This is a little bit of a story question, I think. Friend of mine was in an institution. He drove the wrong way down a highway off-ramp or something like that, so they put him in the institution for a couple of days. And they gave him this long list of drugs, which each had a long list of side effects, none of which the doctor was able to explain to me what those drugs actually were. That the kind of psychiatrist you're talking about that only prescribes drugs and doesn't really care.
Yeah, I could go on about psychiatric drugs for a long time, but the basic summary of my viewpoint is if you actually look in the psychiatry literature, what's actually published in the literature over and 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 over for all types of antipsychotics, antidepressants, all psych meds, clearly demonstrates that at the most, they're only a little more effective than placebo and they have tons of side effects. So there's several sad things about the state of psychiatry. One is they're totally overinvested in genes, brain chemicals, drugs. The evidence for genes contributing clearly shows that genes are only minor contributor. The drugs don't really work very well, and they have horrible side effects. So the profession's kind of painting itself into this death corner, as far as I'm concerned.
Ironically, though, it's making them richer than any other profession.
Not any other medical profession. Surgeons still earn lots more than psychiatrists.
I'm talking about the pharmaceutical companies who make the drugs. They're the most profitable business in America.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've got various long talks, really long talks, short talks I can do on drugs and slides that go along with that. And I just have a little sampling of the combined criminal and civil settlements by drug companies in the last few years. So there's lots and lots of settlements, like with individual states in the 10, 20 million range. But there's now a set of studies in the settlements in the $500 million range. Then we started getting into, you know, a handful above a billion, and we've got a couple in the 2 billion plus. So it's just, as far as I can tell, it's just cost of doing business. And they go, well, we were down a little in the third quarter because we had to pay the government $2 billion. That's the kind of the scale of money we're talking about.
This reminds me of the scene in Fight Club where he says, my job was to apply the formula. How many vehicles would break down? A. How many people might get killed or damage cause in the average out-of-court settlement? B. And A times B equals X. If X is less than the cost of recalling that car, we don't recall them. So it's the same for the drugs as well. If it's if it's cheap enough to pay pay people off and keep it under wraps while people die in the meantime without having to recall the drug completely, they'll do it. It's a business decision. It's not a moral decision. It's not an ethical decision. They wouldn't be in the pharmaceutical industry exclusively if they had morals or ethics in the first freaking place, would they?
Well, they could be in the industry, but they'd be behaving very differently from how they are now.
Yeah. Well, like they're probably in the industry, but not making all the decisions at the very, very top.
Right. There was just on CBS television on Sunday morning, I was watching a little segment about obesity in America and diabetes in America. So this is mainstream, you know, not disputed facts. The obesity rate in children has doubled in the last couple of decades. And if the growth curve continues at its present rate, by 2030, a third of people in America will have diabetes. And by the end of the century, if the growth curve continues, 90% of Americans will be overweight or obese. So that's a little bit of a public health problem. But psychiatry's got a whole set of medications, these called atypical antipsychotics. Not all of them, but many of them cause weight gain, increased blood sugar, increased lipids, which is metabolic syndrome, which is part of this whole health epidemic of cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, you know, high fats, high everything.
And then let me guess, once they gain all that weight, they're going to sell them a pill as well to take every day that helps them lose weight. And when their heart starts to have problems or low blood pressure or something like that, then they sell you another pill that's going to take all that blood pressure. And then that'll throw your kidneys out. So you're going to have another pill to actually help correct your kidney function. And then that'll throw your liver out. So you're going to have another pill. You know, and it just keeps going and coming. Before you know it, you're on 52 medications a day.
Yeah, exactly. In an article that was in the, I'm pretty sure it was American Journal of Psychiatry. It was a leading psychiatry journal. They're doing a study just looking at exactly what you're talking about. And it was in kids aged 12 to 17. So all the kids, and this is published around about 4 years ago or so. I've got the exact reference in my slides. So it's all kids 12 to 17. They've all already been on antipsychotics for at least 6 months before the study starts. And then what they do is in the study period, they add on either placebo or metformin, which is a diabetes pill that you take by mouth. And then what they see is that the kids have already gained, let me see if I got the numbers right here. They've already gained an average of 10 kilos up to the start point of the study, just in the 6 months they were on the drugs. During the study, the ones on placebo gain another 15 kilos for a total of 15 in less than a year, whereas the kids who are on the placebo don't gain weight and their blood sugar doesn't go up. And this is about 50 or 60 kids. I forget the exact size of the study. But two of the kids had to be dropped out of the study because they developed full diabetes caused by the medication. So the authors just report this as not from the perspective you just said, but from the perspective of, oh, this is good. Now we're finding out a way to manage the side effects of our drugs so we can keep prescribing them. When the drugs are literally causing diabetes in kids.
Now, what kind of a monster deliberately makes children sick to line their own pockets?
Well, from the psychiatrist, to me, there's a few psychiatrists that talk are probably just pure scheming psychopath people. But most psychiatrists are just bought into the program, so to speak. And they kind of go, oh, well, our top priority is treating these symptoms. And, you know, we just have to live with the side effects.
Well, I find this very interesting because all of you have to go to college or university or something like that, and all of you have to be taught a recognition of logical fallacies and the trivium, etc., during a philosophy class and what have you. Yet, it's the only thing that is used to argue in favor of these overarching terrible health epidemics, you know. Mm. It's the only thing that allows it to continue. Why is it being taught but not followed?
Well, funnily enough, it's not actually taught in the sense that people go in Canada was even more so because you could get into medical school with only 2 years of undergraduate study, so which I did. So I read like tons and tons and tons outside all that. But if you got 2 years of university, so that means you basically got five courses per year, full courses or a combination of full and halves. For 2 years. So that's 10 full courses that you could take in 2 years. You got to take biology for a year, physics for a year, organic chemistry for a year, and inorganic chemistry for a year. So you've only got six courses left. Oh, you've got to take math for a year. So that's five. So you're now down to five full year courses left over that are, from the point of view of medical school, electives. So you get into medical school very easily without ever learning how to think critically, how to reason, basic principles of philosophy, of argument. And then once you're in medical school, everybody thinks there's all this scientific training. But actually, in fact, medical school is much more like a trade school. It's learning a bunch of facts, techniques. You don't actually learn in medical school how to conduct a scientific experiment, how to analyze evidence, how to think critically about the literature. And then you go into psychiatry, and again, you have a journal club where you kind of discuss some papers, but the ability of the average psychiatrist to really scientifically scrutinize a research paper is pretty limited.
By chance, do they use standard mind control techniques, herd mentalities, forcing or silo mentality / sleep deprivation, massive workload?
Yes, to all the above. So, I went through medical school. I remember, I guess it was second or third year medical school, but somewhere in medical school, we had a surgeon. No, it was first year medical school because, we were doing gross anatomy and there was a surgery resident who was kind of like a teaching assistant in the gross anatomy. And he would come around and give us pointers and help out. And he was just a nice guy. So I was talking to him. And he was a general surgeon. He was talking about a neurosurgery resident. And neurosurgeons are the highest paid and the hardest working and the longest hours in medicine. And, like, are incredibly skilled people. But this neurosurgery resident was completely bummed out and overwhelmed and devastated because they clamped down on him and made him only be on call every second night instead of every night. And he was all devastated because he was going to miss all these good cases. And so in surgery in general, but even more so in neurosurgery, if you're on call and somebody comes in with a serious head injury from a car accident, you can go in the OR at 10 p.m. and not come out till 6 a.m. night after night after night after night. So that's the extreme. But I experienced not dozens and dozens and dozens of nights, but some nights where I got under 2 hours sleep. And you're not firing on all cylinders after that, I can tell you for sure. So there's definitely sleep deprivation. There's kind of life deprivation because there's so much work and study to do. There's a lot of...
That's another technique of mind control is isolation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you'd go into... especially in the internship period, you'd go arrive at the hospital. Depending on surgery, you might have to arrive at 7 a.m. Everybody else probably would arrive at 8 a.m. You'd work all day, go, 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 go. And then normally you'd go home at 7. But if you're on call, you stay, you keep working, you sleep sometimes 4 or 5 hours, sometimes an hour or two. Then you're back at work at 8 a.m., and then you go home at 7 p.m. So from you know, you left home at 7 p.m. yesterday, and you arrive home at 7:30 p.m. today, and that whole time, you've never been in natural sunlight. You've been in an enclosed space, busy, busy, go, 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 artificial light, horrible food, stress, busy. So it's very much a sensory deprivation environment, no question. Then there's the whole kind of groupthink, social conformity, all kinds of...
Any collective punishment?
The collective punishment comes in several forms. Like nobody, very rarely does anybody actually get kicked out of medical school. But if you don't have the right attitude, you just get all this. It's just like being in a, you know, a tribe of 40 people. It's just this little cohesive social unit. And if you get ostracized, like socially, emotionally, by looks, by tone of voice, you're in serious trouble. So it's all kind of interpersonal, social control, tone of voice, facial expressions, what people say, not getting the big handshake, not getting the promotion. That's how everybody's kind of controlled and kept in line. And then there's just sort of modeling. So the doctors behave the way they do, and you pretty soon learn that you better copy them or you're going to be an outlier.
It seems very similar to the way vicious animal trainers would strike a dog if it does something you don't want.
Yeah, except instead of a stick, it's a look.
And they can strike just as hard and cut even worse.
Yeah, they can, yeah. Yes, and you see, like, the first day of medical school, I was a little older than the average student because I was had an illustrious career as a high school dropout for 6 or 7 years. And so I was 27 when I started medical school. And I lived up in the Canadian Arctic and, you know, had all kinds of adventures and so on. But the average, probably 90% of the class, were urban, Caucasian, middle or upper middle class kids who had lived at home with their parents, studied hard, got good grades in high school, went to college for 2 or 3 years, studied, got top grades, got into medical school. And that's their life experience. They walk in on day one. So here's me. I've lived in Sicily, England, the Canadian Arctic. I have 2 kids. I've already published a book or two, writing poetry, reading anthropology, and so on. So their life experience was so narrow. But they were quite an idealistic, you know, young, energetic group of people who wanted to do the best for their patients, wanted to save lives, wanted to learn everything so they wouldn't miss something which would then harm a patient. And then gradually they just get socialized, ground down and socialized into being kind of these, all their feelings are buried somewhere inside, grandiose, narcissistic bosses of the medical field. It's a whole socialization process that was very dramatic and very clear.
But how did they take away a feeling of consequence for actions? Like if patients have bad side effects or something, oh, it's not your fault. They just had a bad reaction and it's their genetics or something?
Yes and no. So if you're an intern or a resident and you actually foul up and something goes wrong, then you can get really chewed out by the attending physician, the boss physician. But as long as you didn't do something like really obviously stupid, yeah, it's all just, well, that's the way it goes, or that's the patient, or these things happen. Yeah, there's a huge minimization of side effects and an overestimation of how effective the medications are, especially in psychiatry, but also quite a bit in other areas of medicine.
Well, and also perhaps a lack of belief or discernment in wanting to use other, perhaps more viable options than the drugs that don't work and actually do worse and harm, which is kind of a violation of the Hippocratic Oath, isn't it? First, do no harm.
Oh, yeah. The Hippocratic Oath is getting stomped in the ground all the time.
I was thinking we need to rename it, you know, for the modern time. I mean, it's like Greeks, you know, that was ages ago. Let's have a Hippocratic Oath, okay?
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that, yeah.
I swear that we won't do any harm, but if we do harm, it's your fault, not ours. Yeah.
Well, the official statistic of the U.S. government is about 225,000 deaths per year in the United States in hospitals caused by medication errors and medication side effects.
Actually, that was updated. It's a...
Well, has it grown now?
It's now one person... No. Seven people a minute or seven people an hour, something along those. It's ridiculous. The leading cause of death in America is the medical system that's trying to save them from dying.
Well, in the United States also... The United States is just a country of extremes all the time. So it's got really wonderful positive extremes, and it's got really horrible negative extremes. But it spends more of its gross national product on health care than any other country in the world by a considerable margin. And in a recent survey, the U.S. ranked 79th in the world on health, the actual health of the citizenry.
Yeah.
Top spender, 79th outcome.
Who were your neighbors there? Were they, Nigeria?
Yeah.
Chad?
Like that. Yeah, things like that. Yeah.
You're actually healthier if you live in Ethiopia than if you've got McDonald's around the corner.
Right. And it was not quite as bad for education. Like in education, like standardized exam performance of high school kids, U.S. is like around 35 or something in the world.
I've had a number of people from New Zealand go to the States, and they were like C students here or something like that.
Right.
And they get like A pluses in the States, and they come back going, man, that student gap year was easy, you know? It was so easy. And I think one thing that's happened to Americans over a number of generations of isolationist culture and not a very well-traveled people is that they don't have an awareness of themselves by comparison to other places. And I think that's what travel and speaking to people from different cultures on a regular basis really gives you. It gives you a perspective. What is that in the background there? Some kind of scraping?
Oh, sorry. I was just twirling the cap from my water bottle.
Oh, sorry.
Good microphone, I guess.
Yeah. Allegedly. Now, if Americans were capable of actually seeing themselves as other people see them, would they change their behavior? I think so.
If they believe the perception.
Yeah. But here's the other thing as well. Another thing that comes with isolation and constant reinforcement of your general belief structure is hubris and blind belief in that structure. You know, there are still Americans today, despite all available evidence, who will still think that the Republicans or the Democrats aren't working together.
You know, there's a whole pantomime of them fighting with each other all the time. It's endless.
I mean, it's like Jesse Ventura said, Governor Jesse Ventura. It's just like pro wrestling. In public, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. In private... Would you like another drink?
Yeah. I was on his TV show in one of his episodes. He's a really cool guy. I like him a lot. And very knowledgeable. I mean, he's obviously a showman. Obviously, he's been a wrestler, was a Navy SEAL. But he knows a lot of stuff about a lot of different topics. He's a very well-studied, well-researched guy.
Oh, yeah. In order to be a SEAL, you need to be in the top 10% of humanity. Maybe top 5, maybe top 1.
Yeah, I'd say one.
Yeah, in terms of intelligence and personal constitution, I think that's actually what it really comes down to, because there's certain things your body can do that your mind won't allow you to, and I think that's what they're looking for when they're looking for the best soldiers, those people who can override their body functions using the strength of mind, and that's what makes them so intelligent and so deadly.
Yeah, he said that the Navy SEALs are not really your stereotypical bunch of, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger type guys. There are guys like that, but there's also like a surfer, a musician, you know, a history major. It's a whole, it's quite a diverse collection of different types of people.
It's the same with Special Air Services in New Zealand as well, rumored to be the best in the world.
Right.
My sisters going out with an ex-SAS guy. And I remember one time when I was a boy, a friend of my mother's, Phil, who just lived down the road to us on the beach, three guys came into his house with a bike chain, a baseball bat, and a knife. Three guys came out of his house. One was dead, one with a broken neck, would never walk again, and the other one with two broken legs and a broken arm.
Right. And yeah, I greatly admire those guys. I don't greatly admire U.S. foreign policy, but those individual guys, I greatly admire them.
Yeah. I mean, let's have a look at what people's achievements are out of context, you know. Let's not think about what part they play in the big machine. Let's talk about individuals as individuals, because otherwise we're just playing the same him versus him. Oh, I hate the military, blah, 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 BS. You know, these are just normal people at the end of the day. You take the boots off, you take the helmet off, you take the guns away. They're just like you and me, except they can freaking kill you with their thumb.
One minor difference, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's the little things that matter, you know. Okay, we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Colin Ross from rossinst.com. That's inst, like instant, or like an institute. And also remember, we are sponsored by a few wonderful little people, the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn there in Auckland. Check that out. We've got a couple of books on sale as well. The Crowdfunding Revolution, How to Raise Venture Capital Using Social Media by Kevin Lawton. The Range of Illusion, a Provinces novel by B. Holmes. You can get those on the homepage. Also check out the Gourmet Soap Kitchen banner down there in Wagga Wagga, Australia. I just love saying the word Wagga Wagga. Wagga Wagga. It's good. It's like a frog noise. And also Blue Shield, because as we all know, there's a hell of a lot of extra nasty radiation stuff coming off of pretty much everything, including the computer that you might be listening to this on right now. All right. We'll see you after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is still Colin Ross. Now, you've come up with trauma treatment programs, I take it. And you said you mostly dealt with children?
No, it's all adults, but all they've had horrible childhoods.
Oh, okay.
And then I also work with increasingly a pretty consistent number of military people with military trauma.
Any people with... I was always thinking about this in terms of military trauma. I mean, there was a film. What was it? Dog Soldiers. Dog Soldiers. Oh yeah, he tells a story. We were patrolling on the Afghan border or something like that, Iraqi border. Sorry, and Richie, poor bugger, triggered an anti-tank mine. You know, lads, it really puts things into perspective when you have to scoop up your mate with a shovel and pop them in a bin bag. You know, you can't think about actually experiencing what some soldiers have experienced without kind of like this intense shock, like a part of whatever they felt at that moment kind of like seeps onto you if you're empathetic enough. And it's quite freaking horrible, man.
That's for sure. I just saw a really, really powerful, one of the most powerful movies I've ever seen, called Railway Man, where Colin Firth was playing a guy who was in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in the Second World War. And now it's kind of flashbacks to the Second World War, flash forwards to him in 1980, and his wife is Nicole Kidman. And they both, Nicole Kidman does a good job, but she's a minor character. Colin Firth does an astounding job. It's really well written, and there's a kind of reconciliation between him and his prison guard that takes place in 1980 when he goes back basically to kill the prison guard. It's one of the most powerful, well-written, moving trauma of war movies I've ever seen.
I do think this is something that needs to really be talked about quite a bit more, specifically because of the fact that people whom this sort of trauma has happened to don't normally like to talk about it.
Yeah, and that's portrayed very, very vividly in this movie.
Yeah.
We have a gigantic problem in the U.S. of suicide in the military. And it includes both guys who've been deployed and guys who haven't been deployed. In both groups, there's between double and triple the rate of suicide compared to the general population. And so I wrote a paper in a journal recently. It was just published a few months ago, titled Self-Blame and Suicidal Ideation in Combat Veterans. And it's basically based on working therapeutically with a whole series of people with combat trauma. So this is, if you figure there's all the guys in the military, then you narrow down to all the guys who get deployed, then you narrow down to all the guys who see combat, then you narrow down to all the guys who've got post-traumatic stress disorder, then you narrow down to all the guys with post-traumatic stress disorder who are suicidal, and then you narrow down to all the guys with post-traumatic stress disorder who are suicidal who get admitted to a mental hospital. So that's a pretty select group. But nevertheless, I think you can learn a lot of general lessons from the most extreme, most disturbed guys. And time after time after time after time, basically without exception, in my experience, which is dozens and dozens and dozens of people, including a bunch of women, the core theme is self-blame for something that happened over there. Either buddy died, civilian children died, civilians died, something bad happened, and the person is blaming themselves. And then the self-imposed punishment is self-hatred, horrible negative self-talk, just tormenting yourself with flashbacks, nightmares, PTSD, believing you don't have a right to happiness or a decent life, believing that you're a monster, believing your family would be better off without you. And in effect, the person kind of court-martials themselves and puts a death sentence on their own head, which then, if you go all the way down the path, leads to suicide. And so you'd think it's kind of dumb. Here's a civilian guy, grew up in Canada, never been in the military, never seen combat. What's he got to say to somebody who's come back from Afghanistan? But I think the reason that I'm helpful is I've figured out this self-blame theme, which is so core and is driving so many of the symptoms. And almost all the time, if I sit down and I walk through the series, so there'll be one or two like key scenarios that happened that kind of represent the entire picture of being over there. So I'll go through one of those key scenarios. And it'll be something like we were in a convoy. I was at the end of the convoy, and the truck at the front hit a IED, improvised explosive device, blew up, and the guy died. Okay, so how's that your fault? Well, I should have been in the front truck. That's where I usually am. But that day, the guy who was supposed to be in the back truck was sick, so my commander told me to take over the position in the back, and he put somebody else in the front. And so it'd be just things like that. When you go through it step by step, it's clearly not the person's fault. And so I go through a process of, okay, let's go through this step by step. Explain to me how it's your fault. Is that really fair? Would you blame anybody else who's in the same position? And basically try and kind of philosophically debate them out of the self-blame to a position that, you know, war is horrible. People die. Not everybody can be saved. It wasn't predictable. It wasn't controllable. It just happened. And you don't deserve to be punished. And what do you think your dead buddy wants you to be doing now? Tormenting yourself? or having a life so that at least somebody got to have a life. So that's kind of like the core theme that I work on all the time. So there's the horror of the events, but underneath what's really driving it is a lot of self-blame often.
Needless self-blame.
Yeah. Humanly normal, natural self-blame, but needless.
Well, who is to blame then? Yeah, and where's the justice for all these people that are suffering these traumas needlessly?
Yeah, the culture does a pitiful job of helping them when they get back home. I mean, there are programs in the military and there's some help, but it's such a drop in the bucket compared to the need.
Well, there's also the need for combat veterans on the front line, to the point in which Department of Defense librarian Douglas Dietrich has discovered that they purposely put black marks on a lot of combat veterans' military records so that when they come home, they've got a certain serial number that when their employers check it up, says that they're a pedophile or a thief or a psychopath or something crazy like that so that they can't get a job. And so it kind of forces them to go back into rotation. The reason being is because if you've got a fresh, if you've got fresh meat coming in, they don't have combat experience and they're a hell of a lot less useful. They don't know what they're doing.
Right.
Whereas if you can force a combat veteran to come back, even though they don't want to, because they don't have a choice, it's a lot more cost effective, more or less. It's a way to save money and lives.
Well, another movie I saw more like about 5 years ago was a very small independent movie called Stop Loss. It wasn't as intense as Railway Man, but it was a well-done movie. And so Stop Loss is a program where you sign up and the agreement is you sign up for this many years and then you're going to get out and you do one tour and now it's time to leave the military. And they just go, nope, we changed the deal. And they redeploy the guy completely like against the initial contract. In a civil situation, it'd be a breach of contract and it'd be a civil case and the whole thing would be taken care of. So there's multiple mechanisms for keeping people in. I've also talked to many guys who just can't fit in at home. And the only place they get a rush and feel alive is in combat. And they can't wait to go back and kill the bad guys and get the rush.
See, and that's the mind control working there, eh? Turning ordinary, good American kids into killing machines.
Yeah. A lot of people think that mind, especially people who are more skeptical, think that mind control is some kind of like huge, fancy, science
machine
fiction
apparatus. No. Mind control has been used for years in the military.
Exactly.
Just basic things like taking away your ability to think by depriving you of sleep is a mind control technique. It's all very simple.
And shaving everybody's head.
Yeah, it relieves you of your identity and your individuality. People can't even tell what color your hair is, let alone what style you put it in to reflect you. Yeah. Do you have long hair or do you keep it cut nice? And you know, do you style it? It doesn't matter. None of that. You're all the same now. If you remove your individuality, it opens the door for collective programming, collective punishment, and things of that nature, you know? You get down and give me 20. No, okay, then everybody has to get down and give me 20 now. All right? So that way everybody starts to obey the master, the sergeant and what have you, because it's to save your life, etc., and to train you properly from being a maggot into a lean, mean fighting machine, blah, blah, blah. Give you all these wonderful promises. It's quite psychopathic in a way, actually. It's exactly the way psychopaths deal with people. They tell you you're the best there is and blah, 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 and then they treat you like crap until they've got what they want from you, and then they just suddenly then reveal, yes, actually, I really don't care about you at all. You're going back over there, son. I don't care if it's on contract.
Yeah, I work with a combination of people who are still very patriotic and loyal to the military and people who feel extremely betrayed by the military. I'm talking about combat veterans. So I've seen kind of like both attitudes a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, see, this is one thing that I actually understand quite a lot, having talked to a number of veterans, etc. But getting them to really talk about their experiences is something that it's like pulling hen's teeth. It's really difficult to get them to open up and just kind of admit that it's not their fault. and to admit that they were fooled and they were lied to or whatever.
Right. But everything's a sign of weakness is the problem.
Yeah, well...
That's how the culture defines it all.
Yeah.
You know, men don't cry multiplied by 1,000. Actually, when every single guy is, you know, bawling his head off inside all the way through.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you got to let it out, mate. And this is the problem, I think, is we're incapable of letting things out. So we bottle them up and then they fester like a... it's like an infection, more or less, that just suddenly sits in there like a cancer, actually. Better analogy. Because it just grows and grows and grows. And it sucks the blood out of your body so that it can continue to grow. And then you get weaker as it grows stronger until eventually it overtakes you and you die.
Yeah, there's jumping out of military combat to child sexual abuse. There's a motto that a guy who writes in the literature came up with. Incest is the gift that keeps on giving. It's just what you're saying. It takes over, it grows, and it just permeates every facet of your life.
I spoke to another man about helping people with that kind of sexual trauma. And his methodology was like almost 2 weeks, Colin, of sitting there talking to these women and men on a one-on-one basis and sharing comparable stories of trauma that's happened in his life as well to help to relay to them, help to them put it in context and that kind of thing. So it's like something that happened to you one instance can affect you your entire life until one person decides to devote a couple of weeks of their personal time to help you get over it now and forever. I think that's the power of people like you, Colin, is that you're able to relieve people of lifelong afflictions that they've inflicted upon themselves.
Right, and they've inflicted them, but not just in no context. They've inflicted these inflictions on themselves because that's a normal human response to trauma. And they just didn't do it out of the blue for no reason. So like kids, for instance, and often the people in combat who are now back home, who are the most suicidal, most blaming themselves, when you go back to their childhood, they were already in the pattern of blaming themselves as kids for family violence, physical abuse of mom, physical and sexual abuse, you know, emotionally absent parents, emotional neglect. So this, I'm a bad kid, and that's why my parents are abusing and neglecting me, gets ingrained very early. And then you just add a whole layer of military on trauma on top. And the reason that kids blame themselves is simply because that's how kids' brains work. Kids always think they're at the center of the world and everything revolves around them and they cause everything that happens. So if you're in like the mythical, healthy, normal family, you learn that the world's a fair place, that people are trustworthy, that you're lovable. So you grow up safe, secure, good self-esteem. Life just rolls out. But when you grow up in a huge trauma family, you learn that you're unworthy, you're bad, you don't deserve love. Your only role in the world is to be somebody's punching bag or sex object. And that gets ingrained over and over and over and over, year after year after year. Then you go into the military and then you're in a firefight and some civilian kids get killed. That, you know, dark monster of self-blame just takes over the whole picture.
Yeah, I think I've actually got quite a bit of that myself, you know. Dad was pretty violent, and then he was gone after 10 years or so of being in my life. And, it's actually been quite a self-blaming life that I've had. You know, why did I do that? Why did I do this? Why did that happen to me? And
working your way out of it is a big project.
Well, what I've found is it's much easier to work yourself out of a hole that you've dug if you've got somebody else to help dig your way out.
No kidding.
And so what I've done more or less is I've tried to, well, this is my job now, more or less.
Right.
Is helping to relay back and forth with other people who may or may not have had similar traumas or things of that nature. And I feel that if I can help them in some way, that in some way it helps me and helps to alleviate my guilt. And at some point I'll be able to say, you know what, I'm no longer guilty at all. You know, I don't feel it. It's not bad. In fact, funnily enough, speaking of mention about the self-guilt and self-hate and punishment, I spent about nearly 2 months not really publishing any shows. I recorded a whole bunch. But more or less nearly two months of doing very, very little work and just kind of like sitting at home feeling sorry for myself, not wanting to edit any shows or record anything more. It just really felt bad. Really, and as I was feeling bad, I started to feel guilty because I'm not doing my shows and donations are still rolling in from people who expect to listen to new shows. So I felt really guilty about that. And then one listener tells me, Vinny, you've spent years and years doing the radio show. You've provided, you know, all this entertainment, all this knowledge and all this counseling to people who've gone through some real crap. I think you deserve it. Stop feeling guilty. And not only did I stop feeling guilty at that moment, I also felt like getting back to work.
Cool. Yeah, people tell me that all the time. Like, I'll work with them and then I'll see them 4 years later and they'll say, you know, the one thing that really made a difference, and there'll be some statement I made that I just thought was kind of like an off-the-cuff thing. So it's you can't always tell who's going to make what statement that's really going to strike home.
Well, that's because it's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? What we interpret a statement to be is more or less what the statement becomes, regardless of how it's intended.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
intention helps it along and pointing in the right direction sometimes. But yeah.
What I use a metaphor, not all the time, but fairly often, of it's sort of like the court martial, but it's in the civilian context of, okay, so what was your crime? My crime was, and it doesn't have to be a legal crime, but a moral, emotional, spiritual crime. My crime was I seduced my father when I was 8 years old and caused him to sexually abuse me. So, of course, we're going to work on it wasn't under your control. It's totally 100% responsibility on him. But before we get to that, I might go, okay, so what's your sentence then? You committed a crime. What's your sentence? And the sentence is being unhappy, being miserable, having flashbacks, hating yourself, having lousy relationships forever. And then I'll go, okay. And what's the length of the sentence? And they'll go, well, life. They're really life. Huh. Well, so some people rob banks and shoot people. The people don't die and they get like 10 years in jail. To get life in jail, you pretty well have to murder somebody. So who did you murder? I didn't murder anybody. Okay, so maybe the sentence is a little out of proportion to the usual sentencing guidelines. And so you're the judge, the jury, the warden, and the parole board all rolled into one.
And eventually executioner.
Right. So let's have a parole board hearing. What does this person really deserve for a sentence? When are they going to get out? And and then it's not just as simple as that, but that's kind of one of the approaches that I use to get the person to reconsider and say, well, maybe I've served my sentence plus an extra 10 years I didn't really need to serve. And maybe it's time to forgive myself for the crime that I never actually committed. And one of the reasons people stall out on that a lot is if you're bad, and you cause the abuse, first of all, you're going to just think that way because kids always think that way automatically. But that means that you've got it contained inside you. This is going on because of the badness that's inside me. So if I figure this out and I decide to be a good little boy or a good little girl, then my parents won't need to do this tough love program anymore because they'll realize I'm a good kid. So it creates this illusion that you've got power and control over the situation. And it's just like the battered spouse who's at the battered spouse shelter. And she's been there. This is her eighth visit to the battered spouse shelter. She keeps going back to the guy. And one more time, she starts going, oh, poor guy's stressed out. Economy's kind of tough. If I just go back and work on being a better wife, he won't be so stressed out and he won't have to beat me up anymore. So it's the illusion that the badness that's causing the trauma is inside you. And if you can just reform yourself and be better, people will stop hurting you. So that thought pattern gets ingrained and is running the show 20, 30, 40 years later. The problem is when you reverse that and you go, wait a minute here, I was just a kid. No kid deserves to be abused. that would appear to be good news because you let go of the self-blame. But then you're face-to-face with the reality of the situation, which is you are really scared, sad, small, lonely, trapped. So it's that powerless, helpless grief underneath that's really hard to deal with. But if you stay all wrapped up in the negativity and the self-blame, you have this illusion of power and control, and you're out of the grief.
It does happen for me a bit as well. I take insults real personal. And it's kind of like extreme defensiveness. And I think it's because I don't feel like I deserve it and feel like some need to kind of like justify my actions and justify myself. And I think I have, you know, I do enough good in this world to justify my existence, I think. I don't think anybody could look at what I do or what I have done for people and say, you know, he's unworthy of life in terms of doing the right thing, I believe. But yet still feel guilty, still feel obligated, and still feel sad and depressed and feel the need to defend myself. It's really, really messed up. It's getting better by the day.
That's good.
But it's still there, and it's a process. You know, like they say in Analyze This, it's grief. It's a process.
Right.
Okay.
That was very funny movie, Analyze This.
It was. And also another movie you've got to see, Colin, considering our discussion of veterans, is The Boys of Abu Ghraib. That was a very, very good film, I must say.
Yeah, that is a good film.
I do. And ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't seen it, for goodness sake, get off your ass. We are coming to break now. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. We are funded by you, the listeners, mostly. Okay, we've got a few ads and banners and things like that on the website, but at the end of the day, the lion's share of the funding for this broadcast comes from you, the listeners, who just give us stuff just because you can. And incidentally, that's exactly the same way all the sponsors work as well. You know, they're not really making a whole lot of money off of this. They're just giving me a little bit so I can continue doing what I'm doing. And I hope that you do too. You can give as little as $1 a month or any amount you want, you know. The more the better, obviously, because it would be really nice if we could expand this operation, have employees, a proper office, or, you know, wouldn't it be really good, you know, far off future kind of thought process that I got a home, you know, like an actual home that I can, like, tear walls down and put in soundproofing and all of that stuff and just be able to have, like, a spare bedroom for people to come in and, you know, train them and to do all this stuff that I can do rent free. You know, it'd be good to have that kind of resources from the community in order to be able to do that, so I can turn everybody into a person with my kind of skill set, so they can go out and they can help so many other different people who've got so many important things to say as well. We'll be right back.
Dreams that
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Colin Ross from the rossinst.com. That's inst like institute, like instant coffee. .com, I mean. And I was going to talk about massage. And it turns out you're just booking yourself a massage. I'm sorry to lay that out on the audience there. You know, he's not that. It's not that kind of massage, ladies and gentlemen. No, not with the hand relief, is it?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay. As long as it's not unfortunately, no. He's a good man. All right. The other element is I always try to massage my wife pretty much on demand. Foot rubs, back rubs, you know, the whole works and stuff like that. And it's about relieving stress, more or less, because she has to leave the house. She has to go work in the wind and the rain and the sun and whatnot, do gardening for a living and what have you. I just have to sit in here and bust my ass on a computer all day. It's not really all that stressful, apart from, you know, emotionally or what have you. So she needs the physical rubbing. And it would be nice to have some of it in return, and occasionally there is, but... In terms of relationships... and trauma, what's it like being in a relationship with somebody who's experienced past trauma and more or less as somebody who's living with that person? How do you, A1, deal with them, and B2, help them get out of that situation so that they're much easier to live with and they can live with themselves much easier as well?
Well, those are some excellent questions. Well, the first thing, the odds that you're going to be living with somebody with trauma are pretty good, because there's lots of people with lots of trauma around. And the number one thing, and I work with people's, you know, partners, significant others quite regularly, or other people in my program work with them. So this is something that's, you know, comes up all the time. And the number one thing is just to be yourself. Lots of unconditional love. Don't take it personally. Realize it's their stuff, which is easier to say than to do. And then it's a balancing act between having empathy, but not just kind of giving them a license to any and all outrageous behavior and self-pity. So sometimes there's like you shift a little bit more over to, not in your face yelling, screaming, but a little more towards confrontation, holding them responsible, a little bit tough love. And then other times you have to shift back to more just empathy and support and being there. So it's a kind of a complicated dance. But the main thing is not to be, we have this triangle that we talk about in therapy all the time called the victim, rescuer, perpetrator triangle. And it helps keep track of all the personal interactions in the person's life outside therapy, and also the interactions inside therapy, not to mention the interactions inside the person. But when the person's been a victim, especially if severe childhood abuse, pretty much by definition, there's a rescuer who failed to show up. So I call that the absent rescuer. And there's been a perpetrator, or two or three or four or five. And so then in adult life, you tend to reenact these triangle relationships. So you're in the victim role still. So then you can perceive your spouse as the perpetrator, because they're not present enough, they're not caring enough, they're not going the extra mile enough, maybe they had a bad day. And then you start being fearful and angry and resentful towards your spouse, who's just being normal. Or you can put your spouse in the role of the absent rescuer, so you don't care enough, you don't show enough love or empathy or concern or whatever it might be. And so it's helpful to track things and go, okay, wait a minute, this is just kind of a replay of her childhood going on here, and I'm just been placed in a role in her drama. It's not really who I am. It's just the role I've gotten stuck in here, and I need to step out of that role and just be myself in the present and not own what that person's putting on me. And then, if the behavior is like extreme promiscuity outside marriage, or extreme substance abuse, or stealing, or crime, or something that's just really intolerable, and the person's not showing any signs of changing, then you got to decide whether it's time to take care of yourself in the form of separation, divorce. But then you don't want to abandon the person, So again, it's kind of a balancing act back and forth between not being too much the caretaker rescuer, being the caretaker rescuer for yourself enough that you stay healthy so everybody doesn't go down with the ship, and then really, you know, firmly and consistently saying you need to get in therapy and I can't be your therapist. And not just kind of some light chat therapy, like serious, hardworking therapy with somebody who knows trauma. So that'd be my kind of quick summary of the role of the partner or spouse.
And in terms of that, if it's somebody else with the trauma, what if you've both got the trauma?
Well, now you've got a double whammy effect and it gets even more complicated to track it all and sort it all out. But I know people who've come through the programs and people I've worked with personally who have really serious trauma histories, who have made amazing recoveries and are healthier than the average adult and really functioning well in life and, you know, would be good partner for anybody. So serious recovery is possible, but then I also know people where there's two people with a lot of unresolved trauma and they're just kind of reenacting and beating up each other endlessly. So it can go from one extreme to another.
Kind of like a merry-go-round?
Yeah, that's not all that merry.
Yeah, a misery-go-round.
Yeah, misery-go-round. There you go.
Yeah. Now, if that is the case, you know, you have actually these sort of relationships with misery-go-rounds, does that affect how people work in their dependent relationships, let's say, on politicians or authority figures, police, etc.?
Yes and no. Some people can kind of keep it relatively compartmentalized. So they function relatively well in public and welcome, you know, relatively well in terms of how they relate to the culture at large and famous people in the culture. And they sort of contain the personal misery in their personal life fairly well. But then other people, it's just like the most unhappy extreme is every way you look, it's just a trauma reenactment. They're voting for or supporting people who are abusive and exploitive of them. They're being manipulated and sexually harassed at work. They're being beat up at home. They're beating themselves up. So, you know, it just depends on the person and the degree of recovery and how much they can, you know, at least have one island of reasonable, sort of halfway sane, safe life going on. And some people have various islands and some people are really short on islands.
Yeah. And no man is an island, because I think there's the other element here that's really important when dealing with personal trauma is having supportive people around you in your life, good friends, supportive family, etc. Because one of the worst things that happens, and this is ironically sought out by many people who have suffered it quite a bit, is solitude. Mm-hmm. And they drive themselves crazy. It's like, who was I talking to? DJ, talk show host, filmmaker, Mikey Havoc. He was on the radio here in Auckland. Mm-hmm. He was sitting in for another guy on Radio Live. It's kind of like one of the largest stations here. And I call in, he's talking about 9/11. And we have a good conversation about it. And he was talking about how when you divulge into things like 9/11, you can turn out like my mate, who was like talking about this all the time, absolutely, and he just drove himself crazy. And right. I asked him, "Your friend, Mikey, you seem pretty well and adjusted to all of this, and you're talking about the same stuff that I'm talking about, probably the same stuff your friend is talking about. Can I ask you a personal question?" Yes, go ahead. "Do you have lots of different social interactions and people that you're talking to and going around and mixing and mingling all the time? Or are you sitting at home most of the time by yourself without an awful lot of interaction to stimulate you outside of these thoughts?" He goes, "Well, yeah, I'm out and about, you know, I'm DJing, I'm partying, I'm making TV shows, everything." I go, "Okay, what about your mate? Was he living a life like you? Or was he the second kind of person I was talking about?" He's like, "He's the second kind." I say, "There you go." It's having people around you that actually believe what you're talking about and don't put you down and ostracize you and attack you and berate you about everything that you say that helps you to stay sane. Because I think one thing that drives people kind of like, and I use the term crazy loosely, okay, because we all get a little bit loopy sometimes when we're angry or whatever. The thing that really, really drives you nuts is being effed off about something that you know is true and nobody talks to you about it or wants to hear about it or wants to believe it.
So that's a problem you don't have, right?
No, I think it's a, it's a problem I've been trying to work my way out of.
That's true. Yeah, I agree.
It's just about changing your social circles, really.
I saw, again, on Sunday morning TV on Mother's Day, a really, really cool segment. So it's the guy's a white guy, professor of anthropology in, I forget what school in New Jersey, and his son, who's... You think he must be half Puerto Rican or something, very Americanized, no accent. And he's talking about his mother. So his mother lives way up the river, you know, 3 days boat trip from the nearest airport in southern Venezuela. And his dad met his mother when he was doing 12 years of field work in this remote village up in the Amazon and married her. And then brought her back to New Jersey, and she stayed 5 or 6 years. And they had 3 kids at this time, 2 younger siblings and then him. The younger siblings didn't remember, but he blamed himself for his mother leaving. But the reason she left was she just couldn't stand it in America. She had wanted to be back with real people in a real place with real community. And so what the son did was hated his mom. And then finally... he got on a plane, went down there, went on the 3-day boat trip, and there's a film crew going along with him. He meets his mother, who's got like a bone through her nose, bone through her mouth, all totally Amazon tribe kind of life. And they hug each other. There's a huge reconciliation. Huge weight comes off his shoulder. But he said, it's kind of funny talking about your mom because somebody says, well, what's your mom doing? Well, she's naked in the Amazon eating tarantulas. But, you know, he got past all that. And he feels a little bit odd when she wants him to eat piranha heads. But he's completely reconciled with her. And her story was, nobody in our village is ever lonely or ever anxious, ever. I mean, compared to what he thinks going on in New Jersey, how many lonely, anxious, depressed, acting out, substance abuse people are there?
Well, and it is Jersey.
Yeah. But it's exactly what you were saying. I mean, just so connected in a human community for real connections, it makes a giant difference. And we've got all this, you know, mental health problems coming from child abuse, trauma, neglect, bad health, bad diets, bad culture, violence in the culture, loneliness, disconnection. It's one gigantic mess.
And I think the culture has been engineered that way because it makes it much easier to divide and conquer people. Would you say that there's really an agenda to kind of like at a social engineering level inflict trauma upon the general population to perhaps make them a little bit easier to control or less resistant to kind of authority? Does it work that way?
Well, it's not like I know for sure because I didn't, you know, go to the Bilderberg meeting and ask them what they're up to. But
in terms of what you see in the happening to the general public, if it was the response of an agenda, would that be the result?
Well, I hear from a lot of people, not thousands or anything, but you know, steady number of people who are telling me. One of my books is called The CIA Doctors, and it's all about CIA mind control experiments, all totally documented. So there are people write to me regularly by email or regular mail, and their story is they're being harassed with electromagnetic weapons by somebody in the government. And so, of course, most psychiatrists just say, here, take this medication. But I personally believe, first of all, these kind of electromagnetic weapons are just facts. they do exist. And there was an article in U.S. News and World Report describing this electromagnetic weapon, the type of aircraft it was in, the altitude of the aircraft, the contractor who manufactured it, the specs of the, you know, in terms of frequency and amplitude.
I believe it's called technotronic warfare.
Yeah. Yeah, there's several different names for it, non-lethal weapons. So these weapons definitely existed. And if you look at the history of testing LSD, chemical weapons, biological weapons, radiation on unwitting civilians, I'd say it's basically guaranteed that these weapons have been tested on unwitting civilian populations. Yeah. And so that would just be kind of the tip of the iceberg as to the level of control and influence that we can do with satellites, cell phones, information age, internet. So what I know about is going to be like half of 0.1% of what's all the stuff that's still classified.
Would you say that there's a spectrum of different mind control techniques and technologies that are kind of influencing the general population at large, all the way from, you know, high school and simple programs like that, through to sophisticated media, then on to weapons and whatnot?
Yeah, definitely. It's just when I kind of differentiate two levels of mind control. One I call psychiatric mind control, and the other I call like either religious or cultural or social mind control. So individual mind control is when you've got one person who's at Abu Ghraib or at Guantanamo Bay. And if you just look at the photos that came out of Abu Ghraib, or you look at the information that comes out of Guantanamo Bay that's in the public domain, they have a whole host of different techniques. They got sensory deprivation, sensory isolation, mock killings, threatening with dogs, good cop, bad cop, electric shocks, sexual humiliation and harassment by female soldiers, trashing your religion, your culture, and the Quran. So they've got a whole host of techniques that they use, not just one. And then when you go into the CIA mind control literature, you can add on hypnosis, various kinds of drugs.
May I just say, that previous list that you just stated sounds like the average high school student's experience.
Yeah, just about.
Except just a little bit worse.
So then when you go to the social level of mind control, it's the same idea. There isn't just one technique. There's a whole like palette of different methods and techniques. And a lot of it, I think, is just basic propaganda through whatever media outlet we have.
So it's kind of like they either get you one way or the other. To a degree. I mean, I came up with a great phrase. How do you know if you're under mind control? If you never question whether or not you're under mind control.
Yeah, that's about it. Well, it's just, I think that our race and our species in the modern industrial world, certainly here in North America, is just in this kind of social trance state, with all these bright lights and, you know, all these media figures and people trash talking each other and singing songs and dancing and all this, you know, colored lights show that goes on. That by itself is a big distraction, which I like and I watch. But if you look at the news media sort of talk style stuff on cable or the major networks, to buy like the official stories that you get through the media, you've got to be in some sort of hypnotic trance state.
Incidentally, the CIA did tests on television flicker rates, not frame refreshes, but they actually how often the lights on the TV flicker, to have the perfect level that the conscious mind can't actually process. So you slip from, what was it, alpha waves to beta waves, or beta waves to alpha waves, when you've got the less analytical mind engaged and it's more emotion, suggestibility, color, feeling, etc.
Right.
So if you're watching TV, you're under mind control after 30 seconds. Brainwaves to it.
Yeah, and then I have several examples of that I use. So how do you sort of trick and quiet the populace? So one of my favorite stories is, which you can Google, it's public domain information. So May 1979, Jimmy Carter's gearing up to try and get reelected. He ends up losing to Reagan. And he's going to give a speech on Cinco de Mayo, which is a big Hispanic celebration, to a Hispanic audience in Southern California. A few days before, and he's going to announce some big financial economic reform platform. Just a few days before that, he's giving another talk, and there's a big commotion in the audience, and the Secret Service wrestles two guys to the ground. And these guys had starter pistols, which couldn't hurt anybody. So the Secret Service interviews them, and they say, initially the Secret Service thinks they're just a bunch of goofball drunks or something, but they say, no, there's this guy who recruited the two of us we'd never met before, and his name was such and such, and he took us to his hotel room, and last night we were up on the roof of the hotel practicing with the starter pistols, and our job was to create a distraction, and he was going to be the sniper who was going to shoot Carter. So the Secret Service says, oh, yeah, these guys are full of it. And then they say, okay, well, here's the hotel room that he was in. So the Secret Service goes to the hotel room, and lo and behold, this high-level, like highly trained black ops guy had left a rifle case and some shells in the hotel room. So then the Secret Service goes, oh, there must be something to this story. So then, and that's the end of the story. These guys are never come to trial. They're never charged. They're never prosecuted. They drop off the face of the earth. There's no follow-up. And all this is reported in the mainstream media, newspaper, television. And the commentators just treat it as a funny coincidence. The funny coincidence is, what are these two guys' names? And so you can do a Google search for these two guys. Raymond Lee Harvey and Osvaldo Ortiz.
No Shiite Muslim.
Yeah. And so Jimmy Carter goes back to Camp David and is reported by some reporters saying, I've lost control of the government. So the story is, just by random coincidence, two guys who had never met each other happened to be in San Diego at the same time as Carter, happened to get recruited by this shooter, and happened to have the names Raymond Lee Harvey and Osvaldo Ortiz. What a coincidence. And end of discussion. Nobody goes, wait a minute. And it's double non-coincidental because Raymond Shaw is the shooter in the Manchurian Candidate book and movie.
That's true.
So it's not even a coincidence. It's Raymond Lee Harvey as opposed to John Lee Harvey or something. And so it's just an example of, like, it's right in front of your face. This is an operation to intimidate Carter. And the signal is, hey, you want Lee Harvey Oswald coming after you or not? And it couldn't be more clear. There's absolutely not one chance in 20 billion that it's a coincidence.
If they didn't want the president to know that he better shut up about whatever, they wouldn't have had it reported in the first freaking place, would they?
Right. But the general populace just kind of, whatever, what else is on tonight?
Well, it's because they've, what was it? I was in university. I wrote an essay, the best essay of my life, the first essay I've ever actually written, where I really put the effort in, did reading and books and bibliography, references, notes, and all of that kind of stuff. You know, really pour my heart and soul into it. It was because it was anti-television discourse, which the topic was one of the topics for essays that I could write. And what I thought at the time, before doing any research, was that television was bad. It basically mind-controlled people, gave them a short attention span, and gave them a whole kind of cultural outlet so that they'd lose touch with each other and never really be able to associate with one another upon anything real, and would instead have to only have things that were fantasy in common that they both observed, like a television show.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Incidentally, almost every single one of the books that I came out and totally agreed with me, and they were written like 40 years ago. And so I put all this into an essay, a documented and everything like that, and they gave me a D minus. A D freaking minus. And I showed this to my one of my school chums' dads, who was a English professor there. He said it was one of the best essays he'd ever written. Gave me a freaking D minus, film and media studies. And I was like, you know what? I haven't made a single film or any bit of media during 2 years of film and media studies. I think I'm going to get the frick out of here. And I did. So I'm a university dropout of film and media studies who'd made more films and more media than any university qualified person in this country, most likely. in terms of the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of videos that I've made.
Well, all power to you.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about education and mind control. I think it's once you realize that that somebody's trying to play a trick on you, that there's a game afoot, that something's not quite right, you deal with it the same way you do with a psychopath in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Quarantine. Get it the hell out of your life.
A little tricky to do when it's the government of the world. But yeah, that's the basic of, only thing I can recommend is just think for yourself. Don't buy the propaganda. Be critical and pay attention to alternative media sources. Don't buy everything they say either.
Yeah, hell no.
But with one exception, which is you, of course.
No. Actually, I'm probably the exception, which proves the rule, that you really can't trust everything that comes out of my mouth. I could be wrong. I like it when I'm wrong, actually, because it means I get to learn something for a change instead of rambling about stuff I already know. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Colin Ross from the Ross Institute. That's rossinst.com. Remember the books on the website, The Crowdfunding Revolution and The Range of Illusion. Pick up a blue shield as well. Protect yourself from a little bit of EMF radiation. Plus, if you want to keep clean, get some of that soap from the Gourmet Soap Kitchen. And if you don't want to stay clean, hey, look, we can relieve some of your habits and habitual choices at the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, is now the final segment with Colin Ross. He packs a lot more power than Colin Powell and a lot less sexiness than Colin Farrell. Welcome back.
Yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle there, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, we're all a child of two worlds.
Well, thanks for the final segment coming up here.
Yeah. Well, I apologize for keeping you so long. It's just so darned interestimo. Now, speaking of trauma, one of my previous guests, I forget his name, it's so terrible, but he was talking about this this conundrum. The wounded healer,
mm-hmm.
as in somebody who can, you can talk to about your pain and your trauma, and not only can he understand it and help you with it, because he's gone through it and dealt with it himself. Is this in any way like you, or you just kind of mostly got into the trauma field and health study because you wanted to help people out of the goodness of your heart?
Well, I didn't have childhood trauma, just normal kind of middle class life. And I wasn't in the military. I didn't have military trauma. I actually decided to become a psychiatrist, and this is confirmed by my mother, when I was 9. And so I have this little memory, who knows of how accurate this is, but I remember watching, speaking of TV, I was watching this black and white movie on TV, and there's a man standing beside an easel with a diagram on it, which is kind of a outline of somebody's head from the side. And there's a horizontal line going through the middle of the head. And above it says conscious, and underneath it says unconscious mind. And I just thought, now that's interesting. And so then I read about famous Canadian doctors and a little bit about psychiatry and so on. And so I was already into it. And then I got sort of off on a tangent and dropped out of high school and was writing literary and philosophical stuff and lived up in the Arctic. But then I got back.
Now you might want to stop twirling that bottle cap there.
Oh, sorry. I just twirled my laptop that time.
Okay.
And then I got back on track and I was, okay, now I'm going to actually be a psychiatrist, which now I am. So I didn't get there by a personal trauma route. And so I think that's handy for me because I'm not like reenacting my own trauma in my professional work all the time. I'm
like
much
me.
More. Well, but you're not just mindlessly reenacting it. You're processing it and healing it.
So I'm consciously aware of it as opposed to unconsciously fulfilling it.
That's good. So when you punch somebody, you do it consciously.
Thing is, I can't hurt people. I haven't actually laid a hand on anybody since I was 15. I used to be a real violent kid. But I figured
good
out,
for you.
Yeah. Well, I figured out that every time I ever hurt anybody, even if I was defending myself, I was always the one that got the blame. So I just stopped hurting people and stopped getting the blame. That was pretty much it.
Good move. So I see myself as an example of the benefits of not having a trauma history, not being a wounded healer, in that like I'm reasonably stable. I can kind of stay reasonably neutral, not get pushed like way over this way, over-identify this way, not get pushed way over there, over-identify that way. And that's helpful to people. But, there's just not one way to do it. So I also know people who have serious childhood histories of trauma. They've really worked on it. They've really resolved it. And they've turned it into really good empathy, really being able to relate, while keeping good boundaries and so on. And they're highly skilled therapists. And then I know other people who are just kind of acting out all over the map and need to stop being therapists. And there's some fields in mental health, like the drug and alcohol field, also eating disorders, where most of the therapists state out loud, I'm a recovered alcoholic, or I had an eating disorder. And so I've been through it. I can relate. And that's perfectly fine and perfectly helpful, unless you just turn it into, I'm going to bill your insurance company, but you're going to do a therapy session for me, and I'm going to tell my story endlessly. So it's more how you handle it, and not so much do you have trauma or don't you have trauma.
Well, it does seem to be one of the most important fields of research in terms of kind of like changing the way the world works, because it doesn't matter who you are or what kind of trauma you suffered or if you've suffered it at all, you will experience people who've had it or be affected in your life by the decisions these people make, whether or not you're one of those people. And the thing is, it's not like a disability, like losing a leg that you can't make go away. You can't get your leg back for love or money. It's something that actually can be healed. But the problem is it's not easy. And because the people who do it have worked a lot of very hard to get into the positions where they can really help people in a lot, often it's without the reach of those people who are very low down, uneducated, not connected in any way to people of this nature to help them deal with that kind of stuff. So you've got like a whole subset of people within the entirety of society who are working down the lower levels and serving us our burgers and stuff like that, who may never get help with their problems.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
So what importance does this actually place on your work personally? I mean, like, do you have any form of idealism, or is it simply a process for you?
I kind of have all of the above. So one of the reasons I moved from Canada to the United States was I was getting kind of politically squeezed down, and the kind of work I wanted to do was just not going to be funded at the research level or the clinical level, and all these political forces were just squeezing it down to nothing. And so I didn't move to like Madagascar. It wasn't really natural. So I moved to the United States. And I got recruited into a private for-profit corporation that runs psychiatric hospitals. And so the reason that I am able to create this kind of sheltered workshop environment where I can do the kind of work I do is one reason and one reason only. That's American capitalism. And the way it works is, back in Canada, the hospital was full all the time. So there was no financial incentive to recruit patients to the hospital to fill beds. We're trying to keep them away. And so if you have a center of excellence where you're going to attract people from other provinces, which I was starting to do, it doesn't create any extra revenue for the hospital. And it's just kind of either a nuisance because you need better trained nurses and more staff, or it's financially neutral. When I moved to the United States, the relationship I have with the corporation is I'm an independent contractor, and I consult to manage and actually do clinical work in these three programs. And the reason they want to contract with me is because of my speaking and my writing and reputation in the field, I can attract people to the trauma programs that the hospitals couldn't attract on their own, and can help them to fill beds, which generates revenue. It's a publicly traded corporation. So this is actually a tiny little niche made possible by capitalism. So that's the upside, you know, of American capitalism for me. So there's an entrepreneurial business element to it. Also, so we still use Fahrenheit in the United States, but Winnipeg, Canada, where I moved from, and Dallas, Texas, where I live now, in January or February on a given day, the high in Dallas and the low in Winnipeg can be over 60 degrees centigrade apart. So that was kind of an incentive to move. And I like the kind of intellectual challenge of it and sort of the Zen aspect of keeping yourself psychically balanced so that you're available to the person as a healer. And I like the writing and the research part of it. And I just like sort of just the human drama and intensity of it. It's kind of like going to that Railway Man movie every day when you go to work. It's just so meaningful, so profound, and so intense. And people can actually recover. Whereas in other areas of the mental health field, there's not really any real recovery going on. So there's kind of there's an intellectual part, there's a business entrepreneurial part, there's a writing career aspect to it, there's kind of a spiritual discipline aspect of it, there's a humanitarian, you know, helping your fellow man, and there's kind of what I can do to try and get the energy field on the planet to be a little bit more positive. So all those things all combined together.
You mentioned the word psychic there. Mm-hmm. Now, I had a listener ask me the other day, did I have any psychic experiences? Now, I believe in extrasensory perceptions. You know, I've seen some things or felt some things before they've happened and that sort of thing. Does it have a real resounding effect? Because I've always been fascinated to know about the mixture between scientific fields, dealing with the mind and trauma and things of that nature, coming across the spectrum and using interesting techniques along with the lines of psychic potential or even religious phenomenon. Do you see a connection between some of the treatment programs, shamanistic traditions, etc., and what you do?
Okay, you said we have another 2 hours?
We could do if you wanted.
Yeah, so not right now. Maybe another time, though. So you've just tapped into a whole nother area that's of great interest to me. So if you go to the Ross Institute website, you'll see on one of the buttons inside is called Ross Energy Systems, which is another company I own that has its own website. And I've got a book called Human Energy Fields. And I've got a patent for capturing the brainwaves that come out of your eye with an electrode, and then using that to turn on, off, up, or down any device on the planet. So it's kind of like a clapper light that you could activate by staring at it. And I've got this whole model of electromagnetic fields, which is very spiritual, philosophical, scientific, all rolled into one. And I have this structured interview that I've used in my psychiatry research that I created in 86 called the Dissociative Disorders Interview Schedule. And it's got a section on ESP paranormal experiences, which is in there because back when I was deciding to be a psychiatrist, I was also reading books about the paranormal and, you know, J.B. Ryan and all this kind of stuff. I gave a talk at the J.B. Ryan Memorial Talk at the American Paranormal Association. So all that interests me tremendously and I think is all tied into the power of the mind to heal the body to heal the mind. I have a paper I just submitted to a journal called Talking About God with Trauma Survivors. And it's really kind of a secular therapy way to talk about people's negative beliefs about God hates me and I'm not worthy of God's love without being, quote, a Christian therapist or a religious therapist. But it's, you know, the power of spirituality is so untapped in regular psychotherapy. And I've also studied, you know, Stargate and the CIA psychic spying projects and all that kind of stuff. And I definitely believe that there's a lots of illusion and, you know, misperception going on, but also there's some kind of core reality to psychic phenomena.
Well, how old are these kind of traditions are you talking about? Are we talking about since the dawn of man we've possessed these potentials or?
Yeah. Well, yeah, since the dawn of mammals, probably.
Well, what kind of abilities are you talking about?
All the standard paranormal abilities. I think, like I said, there's lots of illusion and lots of people thinking that they know this when they don't really, but remote viewing, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, mental telepathy. I basically think that human beings are kind of biological cell phones, well, actually all animals are, and are constantly sending out electromagnetic signals that have information in them that's being received and, you know, trickling through to actual behavior, thought, feeling, and perception. And this is very well known and very well studied by Aborigines or Maori or, you know, North American Indians or whoever. And we've just lost that whole range of sensing the actual real electromagnetic signals that are going between people in rocks, people in trees, people in mammals, people in each other. So we just kind of literally become unplugged from Mother Earth electromagnetically. And this is all very measurable.
It. Somebody was asking me what I thought God was. And I said, you know, all that latent psychic potential, you know, every organism kind of gives off like waves of electromagnetic energy and stuff like that. So that's all part of this one organism that we call the Earth. And this wave of energy that's going around, which has information, etc., is kind of like the will of God. And that's what I think it is. But it's a macro organism. So within me, there's 5 trillion cells, which each have layers and upon layers upon layers all the way down of life. And to each layer of them, I'm just kind of like a fractal version of God, you know?
Right.
Well, to each one of my cells, I'm God. But to inside each one of my cells, they have an entire civilization that thinks that cell's God.
Right. Yeah, the inside of a cell is just this huge, complicated universe. So, I mean, I basically agree with what you're saying. That's more or less my view. I mean, I might say it a little different or put a slightly different spin on it or something, but I basically agree.
Yeah. And in so doing, I think this actually makes it a really interesting version of what God is, because it means I'm God, at least to the cells in my body, and I'm part of a organism of God. So I'm part of God and I am God at the same time. But I only get to have this subjective experience, which is utterly unique, and no other organism, whether they be planets, ants, microbes, or quasars, can have this experience that I call Vinnie Eastwood. And I think that's a very unique opportunity, and we all have that same opportunity. And let's not frickin' waste it, eh?
I agree totally. I just think it's just the simple fact of being alive and being able to see the world is such a privilege and so precious. We just, I think we have a spiritual duty not to trash it.
A moral obligation, as Mark Passio would say. It's kind of like two of my favorite words put together. It's a moral obligation to actually live your life and have fun and do good things.
Right. Sounds good to me.
Moral obligation to think for yourself?
Yeah, for sure.
These kind of things are the motivations of what make good people. And it's not because somebody's paying them to do it per se. It's because it costs you personally to not do it. Can't live with yourself. Or at least I can't anyway.
Yeah, I remember, did you guys have the TV show NYPD Blue?
Oh, yeah.
A couple decades ago? Yeah, I remember there's an episode in there. So there's that gay guy, John, who was kind of like the clerk in the office. And there's Sifowitz, who's the main detective. And I can't remember exactly what it was that happened, but somebody that Sifowitz cared about got shot. And then the criminal kind of more or less got off. And Sifowitz, like, all enraged and wanted revenge and talked about how unjust it was. And John, the gay guy, said, his punishment is not to know God. And Sifowitz just went, oh, okay, I get it. So I thought that was like a very profound thing to throw into that show. And it was especially interesting because, you know, Sifowitz, who was kind of homophobic guy, kind of a racist guy, kind of a hard guy, you know, got this life lesson from the gay guy. So that was a really nice piece of drama.
I like those little juxtapositions in life, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You never know who you can learn off. And I think that's kind of like one of the guiding principles of this show. Everybody's got a story.
That's for sure.
Yeah. But the more stories I learn, the greater my perspective becomes. The greater my perspective, the greater my understanding. The greater my understanding, the greater the complexity of my soul.
So we've clarified that your liver cells think you're God. So how about your wife?
No, she thinks I'm lowly.
Oh, too bad.
Well, the thing is, I'm narcissistic by nature, so it helps that I'm with somebody who hates my music, hates the sound of my voice, and is constantly berating me and telling me I'm terrible at what I do. Okay, it keeps me grounded as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's what a wife's there for, isn't it? Did I miss something?
I think you might have missed a little alternative flavor you could throw in once in a while. Yeah,
yeah, I know, but those are the staple diet. There's also the loving, the caring, the that thing, you know.
Right.
That you do with your wife, and the cooking, the gardening, and doing all of the things that we do together, you know.
Yep. Poking a pin in your grandiosity is a very helpful thing for a partner to do.
Yeah. And I've got lots of grandiosity. The other element is it's quite important, I think, that we just bug each other all the time. You know, there'll be, for no particular reason, she'll come into my office or I'll go into the lounge to see her and just go, I love you.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so profound and sweet and sickening.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, I like that routine as well. The more stupid and corny and sickening it is, the better.
Yeah, and
not all the time.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there's a time and a place.
Right,
time and a place. It's a dance, right? And I think that's what's his name, Randy Morgans, said during a show we do called the Man Talk Project about how you know, you've got to really kind of take your partners into consideration. They've got to take you into consideration, and you do a little dance.
Absolutely. I looked through your list of jokes on your website there. I like the Montauk one. That was good.
Oh, yeah. What was it? What was that joke?
I don't remember how it went, but it was.
I remember.
On the Montauk project. Right?
Okay. What do you call a program where they teach people to speak with a Jamaican accent?
That's, yeah.
The Montauk Project.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of Mon jokes in there.
Yeah, I know. I saw a few, yeah.
Yeah. What was the other one? Oh, yeah. What do you call a Jamaican-themed tanning salon?
What?
Montana.
Oh, yeah, Montana. I don't remember that one. I'm not sure if that one was on the list.
I've got to update my jokes. Like, I've got, I think, maybe three different text files on my computer that I, you know, sometimes I just come up with really lame jokes. In fact, all the time I come up with really lame jokes and just write them down somewhere, you know, otherwise I forget them.
I helped a person who was working on a homework assignment, a paper, basically, for an education class way back. And it was a paper on research on child's humor. And so there's a whole field of study with, like, papers and conferences and magazines and everything where these guys study children's humor from a developmental perspective. And so they'll go in and they'll tell the same joke to a bunch of three-year-olds, and they're all like, what? And then they'll tell it to some five-year-olds, and they all burst out laughing. And then you say, well, explain the joke. They have absolutely no idea. And then they'll tell it to, like, seven-year-olds, and they'll laugh, and they'll say, hey, well, here's why it's funny. Here's how the joke works. And so in this academic literature, there's just, like, endless supply of ridiculous, funny kids' jokes. It's kind of a cool area of study.
Yeah. I always wanted to publish one of those joke books. You know, you see them in the bookstores sometimes, 101 jokes or whatever, you know.
Right, right.
I've probably got well over 100 jokes already amassed.
Oh, good.
There needs to be a culling, though, because some of them are just bad. I mean, they're just not funny. Okay, Colin Ross has been my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. His website is Ross Ernst, as an instant or institute, which incidentally didn't form in an instant, I'm betting. And also rossenergysystems.com as well, with that little EMF clicker thingy that you activate with your eyeballs. Is that about right?
That's it.
All right. I got it down. And plus, remember, ladies and gentlemen, the Vinny Eastwood Show, if you're listening to this on live broadcast and, if you're listening to this on the radio, you're probably listening in New Zealand, either through Rush FM, there's a banner on the homepage there, Ifinity FM, and Dagsy FM. I'm also a monthly contributor to the UnitedWeStrike.com radio broadcast. And also, remember, ladies and gentlemen, your donations are what pays for the existence of the show and the ability to get voices like Collins and everything else out there. So if you want it to continue, please go to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood, as in go ahead, make my news, and donate today, or give us a little bit of a subscription there, preferably if you're in New Zealand, to the Kiwi Bank account there, because PayPal always takes a percentage, in some cases up to like 20 or 45%. I think the bigger donation, the less percentage they take, but they always take something, which would never mind. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Colin.
Thanks very much.